Take a network break, grab a gluten-free, paleo-approved virtual donut, and join the Pack of Pushers for a week's worth of tech news analysis in 45 minutes or less. I'm Drew Conry-Murray. Greg Farrow is also here. This episode is being sponsored in part by ThousandEyes. ThousandEyes delivers visibility into every network your organization relies on, from your data center to the cloud. You can quickly and precisely pinpoint the root cause of network issues wherever they occur. Sign up for an account at ThousandEyes.com/packetpushers to monitor 3 locations for free and choose a ThousandEyes t-shirt. Network Break is also being sponsored by Interoptic. You can purchase high-performing optics designed by engineers who truly understand what you need at a fraction of the cost. Get more information at interoptic.com/packet-pushers. And tune in to hear the Packet Pushers Weekly Show 360. You can hear Interoptic CEO Tim Dixon as he opines about transceivers, the Shannon limit, and the future of optics in the data center. All right, to the news. VMware has announced its intention to purchase SD-WAN startup VeloCloud for an undisclosed amount.
No surprise, but a surprise, really, isn't it? Bit of both.
A little bit of both, yes.
I mean, obviously, everything you want to talk about here is going to be, but what about Cisco and Viptela and blah, blah, blah. You can't help yourself. But I do remember saying when we talked about the Viptela acquisition that it's highly probable that VMware will buy somebody. I did, I actually said at the time it might be VeloCloud because that's the most natural fit.
Ding, ding.
I hope I did. Yeah, because then I can say, I told you so. But I'm not 100%. So, yes, VMware is attaching onto VeloCloud. No rumors about numbers, by the way. Haven't been able to find anywhere where the number about how much it paid for it was.
Nope.
Which would be interesting to know because Cisco was obviously bragging heavily about how much money it spent on Cisco likes to tell you how much it spent. It's like an ego thing. Like,
it kind
of
is, hey, a little bit.
We spent $600 million. That's a great thing. And it's like, actually, you know, maybe not. But anyway, they definitely paid a lot of money. I wonder what VeloCloud went for. Hopefully the secret will come out and then we can sort of put it into context. Of course, VeloCloud is a different, very different to Viptela and to most other SD-WAN providers. It is not a hardware play. It is a pure software play. And the way that it works is it has a network of points of presence across various data centers on the internet. Some of them are in cloud, some of them are in colo or hosting facilities. And that network acts as a backhaul. So what normally happens is you put either an appliance or a VM at the edge of your branch, and then it trunks the traffic over load balances over multiple WAN connections. But its real value is actually in the backbone POPs. So it actually does like a private backhaul or a public backhaul network over the internet, which is supposedly going to do something different.
Yeah, that was its secret sauce in that it had it controlled its own network, so it could presumably you didn't have to risk being on the public internet with your traffic and also get the performance benefits of having a controlled, tightly, essentially a private WAN almost.
That's right.
But with the SD-WAN goodness thrown in.
Well, at this point, what you're actually doing is just using the internet as a local loop or bypassing the local loop. And this, of course, made it very attractive to service providers or telcos who want to run managed services businesses, because now instead of waiting 6 months or a year to negotiate a 2 meg frame relay tail in Asia somewhere, you can tell them just go connect up to the internet and then pop this box on and then we'll trunk you back to our network. So if you've got a customer who's got an existing private WAN, you can sort of pretend that you've got a managed WAN service and slap it on over the internet and bolt it onto your existing. And it kind of lets a lot of the carriers pretend that their private WANs are actually still worth it while actually reaching out. It expands their customer, their footprint without actually rolling out a network in a funny kind of a way.
Right. Absolutely. Yeah. So that's why VeloCloud went after service providers as well as the enterprise market.
Mm-hmm. And they did a whole bunch of things. They did branded reportals so that when you go on, you won't necessarily know that there's a VeloCloud underneath. You'll just see a skin portal that sits in the cloud somewhere and you see the WAN bandwidth and all that sort of stuff. So it's been very popular. So I do wonder if VMware has some intentions here to break into telcos. It's been struggling to get into the telcos here. It's been trying to push the ESX hypervisor as the NFV platform of choice and, of course, NSX. And I think telcos have pretty comprehensively rejected that to go down the ONAP open daylight path because the cost of, you know, at telco scale, if you're going to pay hundreds or thousands of dollars of licenses per node,
right,
it just doesn't work out.
Yeah. No, the economics do not work out at all.
No. So perhaps this gives VMware another chance to find a way back into the carriers, this time as a managed service provider or providing an infrastructure play rather than, you know, something that's actually established, and see if VMware can try and keep its, you know, let's face it, VMware has a well-deserved reputation for sticking it to us in terms of pricing. It's pretty generous about how it prices its products, and it likes to charge high prices. And telcos, pretty sharp players. So if you're an enterprise customer and you've got VeloCloud, that's probably a good thing, because ultimately the way it's going to work is you're going to get this micro-segmentation right the way out to the edge of your branch. And then I think over time, you're going to see this strap into the data center. So the micro-segmentation you're seeing in your data center now is going to be able to reach all the way out to the branch.
Yeah, and that's a point that VMware was making in a conference call with press and analysts, wanting to tie in the data center to the WAN. They were also very clear that this was an opportunity for them to expand their networking footprint out of the data center. So they've got data center with NSX. They've also started in public cloud networking with virtual NSX, and now they can go into the WAN space through the VeloCloud acquisition.
Yeah, and that's absolutely, you know, of course, that's what getting into the WAN starts to make sense, especially when VeloCloud doesn't really have a hardware strategy. It's not like VMware suddenly has to get into holding stock of routers or something that...
That their edge gateway devices are built off of x86.
That's right. So I suspect you'll see VMware partner up with Dell, just like they're doing with VxRail, so that you can buy a box to put on-prem, and it'll be one of Dell's IoT edge devices, or they'll produce a box with an x86 server and a half a dozen Ethernet ports or a dozen Ethernet ports in it that you can put at the branch edge. That's exactly the sort of thing that Dell does well. But it'll also be an open hardware platform, so anybody else can build it. But who's going to? Basically no one.
Again, on this conference call, VMware was very clear. We're not interested in getting into edge hardware. They want to make this eventually a software-only service where they'll ship you sort of a virtual instance and you can run it on, you know, the sort of certified hardware of your choice. And they'll obviously offer as wide a spectrum as they can. But they don't want to get into building some kind of router or switch for that endpoint gateway. They want to keep this heavily software focused.
Yeah. And, you know, we've seen other SD-WAN providers, you know, like Riverbed and, you know, get into this branch in a box thing. I think we covered that 6 or 8 weeks ago, where they're looking to provide the Wi-Fi as well as the switch, as well as an appliance that does all of the application level functionality. So it actually becomes, you know, the thing that we've always aspired to over the last 20 years, which is really a branch in a box. It's got a print server, an IP address manager, a firewall, an application firewall, a logging engine, a monitoring engine, blah, 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 malware scanning, and everything in a box so that you can control a whole branch remotely. I don't think VMware is going to go into that space, and maybe they'll try and lean on their partnerships to make that work. But I do think that is ultimately where we're heading in the WAN. Certainly with Cisco, they're going to take a point of view, I think, where you have to use our hardware, because what we need to do is we need to give you some Wi-Fi and some LTE, and we want to give you some Ethernet ports and some switches and some blah, 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 and you can run all the via, and that's going to be a different sort of a sale. And I think Cisco's approach might be a lot more attractive to customers than VMware's sort of, here's a piece of software, suck it up. You know what I mean?
Sure.
You know, yeah. Make something out of that sort of thing, which is not, I'm not sure that that's where networking is. I think networking is still, at the branch, I still have to put a thing there. Ultimately, you know, with the hyperconverged platform that VMware tried to put together, they've learned in the end that you really have to have your own hardware to make that work. You can't just rely on partners to follow in behind you. They're not going to do that. So on the whole, very exciting. I think it shows you that SD-WAN is a big deal. I think it shows you that VMware wants to reach out and, of course, put some head-to-head against Cisco in absolutely into Cisco's core business. And
sure.
Yeah, yeah. And given that Cisco hasn't had a great success with ACI in defeating NSX, I would say that, you know, those two are running neck and neck. I mean, you know, my sort of sense at the moment is that the SDN market is kind of split into three pieces. There's ACI, which gets a third, NSX, which gets a third, and everybody else shares the last third. So there's still plenty of room for SDN to move around, especially, you know, the data center. And then by stretching it out into the WAN, it's going to be a big deal. The challenge for Cisco, of course, is if they try and treat Viptela in the WAN separate from ACI in the data center as separate from the campus, I think they're going to lose, because customers don't want that. Or over time, I think that you'll see that people feel that the data center and the WAN should all just be one network. It shouldn't be fragmented into chunks, if you know what I'm saying.
Yeah, that's what I was wondering. If this means that VMware at some point may also want to start playing in the campus with some kind of overlay software-driven solution as well to link everything together.
Yeah, and that's a lot harder, because in the campus you have to do Wi-Fi. And that's, you know, you can't help but wonder if Cisco did get a sniff that NSX was looking at buying VeloCloud, and that VMware was looking to, you know, to do this. And Cisco kind of rushed. I mean, SDS access always looked kind of rushed and immature. It really wasn't, you know, the usage of Lisp doesn't make sense. The software platform that sits on top is still 2 years away. You know, very Cisco sort of, you know, we're going to do this, but, you know, it's only 2 years away.
Announce early, stake your claim, yeah. Try to introduce some.
Yeah, I think ultimately what NSX could be doing in the long run, and what the smarter play here would be for NSX to be starting to pitch itself as an IoT appliance. So that is, there is a version of NSX which comes as a library that you can compile into your IoT Edge. That's something that Cisco's much more has done a lot more in there. They spent, you know, $3 billion buying Jasper just to get into that market. Ultimately, there are a lot of companies out there who are building SDN solutions out of tying IoT and securing the network so that, you know, if you're going to connect some sort of edge device that's monitoring buildings or cars or streetlights or whatever, it has its own overlay networking that's secured and separate. It just uses internet, but it connects back over proprietary. And the actual networking stack is actually compiled into the IoT app at the edge. And I'm wondering when NSX is going to announce that. And this is a step in that direction, because once you've got the VeloCloud backbone, you can now start to spin that into an IoT network. That's looking a bit further down a 5 to 10 year horizon about where NSX needs to go to maintain its relevance. And, you know, if you're going to build an IoT data center with NSX in it, then you need to have NSX in the IoT appliance. You can't just let them use HTTPS over the internet, I don't think, so if you want micro-segmentation. So great news. SD-WAN's still hot. This is a great move where Cisco now has a major competitor. If you're an enterprise partner, you know, who's looking at doing SD-WAN, you can now say, I've got two solutions to choose from. I've got the Cisco Viptela Reps SD-WAN solution, and now I have the VeloCloud. Both of these acquisitions are still in flight, and Cisco's still working out how it's going to put Viptela into its portfolio, according to everything I've heard. It's still a year away. But if you are looking at, you know, over refreshing your branch WAN, now's the time to start talking to these companies and seeing where they're going to be in a year and then starting to move down those paths, I think. But fantastic, really exciting, I think.
So Cisco's made its move. VMware has made its move. Still a lot of SD-WAN startups out there. Do you anticipate any of the other quote-unquote legacy networking vendors making a play here?
Well, I think some of the other, like, there's really nobody left. Like, Brocade's gone. Extreme Networks is going to be digesting the cow, the Avaya.
The Avaya and Brocade portions, yes.
Brocade acquisitions. You know, it's got to just digest all of those. It's got multiple wireless strategies now. It's got multiple campus strategies. It's got multiple data center strategies. And it's going to try and go to market with all of them in the short term, work out which one stinks the least, and then pick the one that doesn't stink so bad. That's obviously, you know, going to be the most successful, and then work out what they're going to do. You're almost certainly going to see some sort of headcount reductions in the near future as they try and squeeze some dollars out of getting, you know, they bought them all pretty cheap. It's not like they spent $600 million buying these switching companies. I mean, they got Brocade for $100 million. They got Avaya for $100 million. They got a real bargain for those.
Yeah.
So I do think that Extreme's not likely to jump into this. And we've got other companies out there like Juniper still trying to convince people that, you know, smart configuration of devices is SD-WAN. And it's really not. SD-WAN is not configuring the WAN edge, you know, scripting the CLI or polling some APIs. It's actually about smart software features to do path selection and acceleration, as well as a whole raft of other things. You know, when you go and talk to Silver Peak about what they're doing, or, you know, or others, there's just, it's not just about configuring the edge. So I think these other companies need to sort of make a decision about what they're going to be doing with themselves, and about, they need to realize that it's not about routing or path selection anymore. It's far greater. It sits right above it. You know, like NSX is effectively saying, we now have a networking strategy that moves from the branch to the data center that includes firewall integration, network functions virtualization, traffic management, traffic optimization we can do, routing at the edge. All those features that NSX has got is now going to be added to the WAN. And I think that's going to change things over time.
All right. Well, speaking of SD-WAN, we've got a story on FatPipe. They announced that the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office has upheld a quote-unquote signature claim in a patent relating to load balancing over disparate networks, which itself is a key feature of SD-WAN. So I'm wondering what FatPipe is going to do with this intellectual property it's got a hold of.
There's trouble down there in SD-WAN town.
So we had an up story, now we have maybe a little down story.
Yeah, so FatPipe started doing what we would mostly think of as SD-WAN around the late 1990s, I think in 1999. And they've got a bunch of patents that they laid down asserting various claims around, you know, path load balancing and stuff like that. There's not really a lot of information in here, and FatPipe won't make any comment because it's all legal hoo-ha. I'm a bit sort of baffled as to why they even released a press release if they're not going to talk about it. But just be aware that there might be some road bumps in the path to SD-WAN. And FatPipe, which is a little known company, hasn't really made a huge impact on the market over the sort of last 20 years, does have some patents that may actually cause people some troubles in the near future. So keep an eye on that. It's probably going to cause the vendors troubles less than customers.
Yeah, customers shouldn't have to worry about this. It's going to be some discussions among the legal departments of various organizations, I think.
Famous last words. If they do, you know, sell them off to a patent troll, you know, who knows where it'll go.
Right. Yeah, maybe someone should go and buy FatPipe pretty quickly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, indeed. Mm.
All right, moving on. Bloomberg is reporting that Cisco is looking for a buyer for a piece of its service provider video business, which itself comes out of Cisco's 2012 acquisition of a company called NDS. Cisco acquired NDS for about $5 billion. They make technology for cable and set-top boxes. Bloomberg notes that Cisco's service provider video biz has had declining revenues for the last 3 years, so it looks like they're trying to get rid of this and maybe get a little money back.
Yeah, I think this was the last throes of the John Chambers CEO model of business, which is where if something generates traffic on the network, then it's good for networks for sales. And anything that's good for sales is good for Cisco. And so he looked around and there was all of these telcos that he was doing customs with were running NDS, which is the way that they deliver video over their closed networks. So private networks, so companies like Comcast and so forth, streaming video over their internal networks and selling it. And of course, 5 years later, it's even more obvious than it was in 2012 that it's a dead and dying business model. The cable providers are losing out big time. There's massive reduction. You know, people are just walking away from cable video at a fairly substantial rate. If you're actually tracking some of this, there's actually some really interesting stuff going on here where the cable companies, if they lose many more subscribers on the cable network, they won't be able to own the rights to the NFL going forward because they won't be able to pay for it. Because the suggestion is that Netflix and Amazon may actually start bidding for sports rights.
Well, Amazon already does have some rights to certain NFL games, yes. And I could see Netflix. Netflix has been very willing to throw billions of dollars at content. So, yes, that's interesting. Cable's advantage right now in terms of content is its control over live sports, which is very hard to get via other streaming services legally. If they lose their grip on that, then, yes, it's pretty much game over for traditional
cable. We're going to see a recalibration. I think, ultimately, the idea that you have to connect to a private network from a specific company to get access to their video is probably not what the internet's about. In the same reason that we connect SD-WANs to the internet so we can connect any point to anywhere in the world, it doesn't matter, then the same thing applies to video. And the days of having to own a private network to guarantee reliable video are pretty much dead. So we know that Netflix works pretty fine over the internet, no matter what you say. Suck it up. So Cisco spent about $5 billion for NDS. I think I was actually saying at the time that this was a dumb idea because in-network video is really stupid. But I think Cisco had hoped that if they could take control of that and then add that, that carriers would turn to them for their network refreshes because Cisco could take the whole thing. But of course, what we're actually seeing is companies like AT&T, Verizon actually just turn to open source. OpenStack, ONAP, Open Daylight, and say this is what we're going to use to manage these networks. And that over-the-top video stuff, now we need to deprecate that. So Cisco, I think Chuck Robbins is saying there's no money here. We're not going to be the leader here. That's a dying business. Get rid of it and start focusing on the things where we are going to be successful. And that's the new things that he's bought in the last year or so.
That's right. Well, I mean, if better to get out now instead of holding on and waiting to see what happens, because we can pretty safely say it doesn't seem like traditional cable TV is coming back. So,
well, I think you'll see it just as a very high speed internet over time. But
yeah,
when you're extracting a lot of profits out of, you know, when you're charging $150 a month, I think it's like $100 to $150 a month, the average cable bundle.
Yep.
And the way that you justify, you know, make that price is by justifying the video. Where if you just get turned it into internet, is it worth $100 a month? Probably not.
All right, one more Cisco story. At the company's recent partner summit, Cisco unveiled a host of new changes to the way it's going to operate its reseller programs. There's a lot of insider detail that will be of interest if you're a reseller, but if we went over it here, we'd just bring the podcast to a screeching halt. So there'll be a link in the show notes if you really want to go look at it. But one thing that jumped out to me is Cisco's intent to move partners to lifecycle and recurring revenue. And here's a quote from the announcement. This sales model supports Cisco's transformation as a software company and facilitates partners, recurring revenue streams, and high-value services. So, in other words, Cisco's moving to this SaaS-based like business model with recurring revenue. Resellers better get on board.
Yeah, well, a lot of resellers basically rely on tin shifting, which is where they bid for a piece of hardware and then they sell it and then run away as quickly as possible and grab the profits and put them in their pocket. Now that Cisco's saying, no, we're going to start leveraging you for recurring revenue. So what that probably means things like, sure, we'll give you a commission for the first year of sales, but we'll give you a bigger commission if you stay around for the second year and the third year. So instead of these pump and dump Cisco resellers just desperately trying to get volume up and drop gear for the cheapest possible price, this is a massive change because the only way you're going to hold on to customers is if you're actually genuinely adding value.
Mm-hmm.
And keep in mind that as a reseller, if you're selling SaaS, everybody's selling exactly the same SaaS.
Right.
Right.
Differentiation becomes a little harder.
Yeah, I would not want to be a Cisco reseller. As I said, I don't believe resellers can last much longer, because if your cash flow is linked to, you know, if you're struggling with cash flow now and keeping headcount, you know, if you've got to keep headcount around year on year, and then you're pulling up SaaS revenue, which is giving you this 1, 2, 3, 4, you know, if that revenue is defined over a 5-year horizon, you've got a whole bunch of accounting problems just to change your business planning. And also, how do you actually hold on to staff in that environment? How do you cover your costs? How do you build a warehouse and have spare parts and inventory and service inventories when the revenue is going to be delayed over time? I think it's going to be a tough time for Cisco resellers. And if you're working for a reseller, start looking nervously around at how long you'll be around, because I really don't think that's going to be a sustained industry over time. At the end of the day, I still believe that Cisco likes resellers because it's cheaper than doing it themselves. And at some point when you get to SaaS, resellers don't make sense. Customers can just come and buy it directly from Cisco.
Yeah. I think, yes, it's going to be harder for resellers. I can see the reseller market shrinking. I don't think it's going to go away, because I believe there are organizations that are actually looking for value, and that there are resellers who can provide value on top of just shifting tin. But yes, it's going to get harder to run a business like that.
Yeah, you've really got to get smart. It's no longer sort of these loc merchants who come in and treat Cisco products like used cars. I got this one. It's a great one. The great car. It's in the store. It's in the stock. You can buy this one. You know, I sell it to you. Special price for you. Special price for you. You know, and sort of get the cash and then go next.
You know? That's right. And out the door you go.
Yeah, I think that's going to be a challenge. Yeah.
All right, a quick break to tell you about one of our sponsors today. That's ThousandEyes. As your network expands to include cloud services, ISPs, and third-party providers, your visibility diminishes. And that's a huge problem when you're running critical applications, websites, and services. ThousandEyes gives you visibility into every network your company relies on. That's your corporate network, the internet, cloud service provider network, and you get it all from one place. ThousandEyes cloud agents are deployed in locations all across the globe, and enterprise agents provide additional visibility from within your own network. And together, these vantage points provide the most complete understanding of network topology, dependencies, and behavior. And how can ThousandEyes help you? You can piece together multiple layers of network insight, from BGP routing and DNS to the web server and layer 3 performance. You can quickly and precisely pinpoint the root cause of problems like device faults, congestion, DDoS attacks, and more. You can share data and insights with vendors and customers to resolve problems faster. And here's a special offer for Packet Pushers listeners. Sign up for a free account at ThousandEyes.com/Packet Pushers and choose a free ThousandEyes t-shirt. Start seeing your network like you've never seen it before. ThousandEyes, it's network intelligence you can see. All right, back to the news. Juniper has announced the programmable photonic layer, which the company says disaggregates optical control from the underlying network elements.
Yeah, so this is actually quite interesting. Bit of a surprise for me, optical software that's disaggregated from the hardware. Although you can buy Juniper's hardware, the TFX1000 or something like this. Basically, what they're really touting here is two things: an operating system that goes on an optical switch, which can be Juniper's or can be somebody else's if that makes you happy. And they're also talking about the ProNX Director, Optical Director, which is an optical SDN solution. So really what we're seeing here is that about a year ago, 18 months ago, Juniper bought BTI Systems, which was an optical MPLS edge company. And this looks like they're finally bringing some products to market. A little bit slow. And Juniper's always a bit slow to get things executed. They can't seem to trail a long way behind. But this builds out the MPLS optical edge that Juniper's got going on. If I had the time and I was working in a biggish sort of an enterprise and you've got some dark fiber, I'd probably look at this as a data center interconnect technology, because if you can put DWDM down and start lighting up multiple 100 gig wavelengths, you can actually build like a couple of terabits of bandwidth between data centers. Forget all that other rubbish, right? Just put bandwidth in there, and then all of that DCI just becomes moot. And you can run your NSX over the top of that and just pretend your data centers are the same. There's only a bit of latency between the sites. So yeah, I think it's actually quite interesting. This is really quite something from Juniper, and it's disaggregated. So instead of being stuck on, you've got to buy our fancy, smashy hardware, it's they're embracing this commoditized, disaggregated ROTMs and a chassis to run our software on and light it up.
All right. Good job, Juniper.
Yeah, yeah. So just be aware that this is, again, takes a little while to get there. A final word of warning, this idea of disaggregating optical has been around for a while. We saw Facebook via its TIP, telecom infrastructure project, announced one that doesn't seem to have gotten too many legs, but then these things take time. Carriers move at glacial speeds. So I've sort of sent, there was an open optical push around 7 or 8 years ago that sort of went nowhere. So yeah, we'll see how it works out, because there's some good hardware coming from Juniper. I'm inclined to think that this might have some long-term legs. You might start with the custom hardware, hoping that some open hardware comes down the pipe.
All right, check it out. We'll have links in the show notes. This is slightly older news, but it's also optical related. In September, Ciena posted kind of a braggy blog about its WaveLogic AI chips, or AI chips, enabling 400 gigabits per second in transport networks.
Bandwidth is king, baby.
Oh, yeah. 400 gigs.
400 gigs on a single wavelength up to 500 kilometers, depending on the nature of things. So that's just like, wow. Because you can actually have ROTMs with 48 wavelengths or 96 wavelengths. I'm pretty sure it might not work on all of those. But fundamentally, they're talking about moving the needle today is around, you know, at the highest end is 100 gig on a per wavelength. And now they're saying with this technology that they're announcing in this particular press release, they're now saying we can automatically, wherever you're using 100 gig today, we can now clock up the 200 gig over every wavelength. So they double the bandwidth, right? Right, yeah. Underneath, yeah, on, yeah, your existing stuff just by going through and replacing with this new stuff. And we can actually now go to 400 gig in the near future. So tell me again about why you need quality of service when the WAN can just, it's just got these massive increases in performance coming. Don't tell me about your private MPLS. You're just making me laugh at this point. Bandwidth is king, baby. Bandwidth is king.
And they did announce also as part of this a trial in New Zealand between a couple of data centers in Auckland. So they're actually getting proof of concepts out there as well.
Yeah, some interesting, you know, you have to understand optical, and I'm not, don't claim or want to be an optical expert, but I know enough to sort of go like, wow, 400 gig? That's better than 200. And way
fast.
Better than 100. Speed, baby, speed.
Right. So we've been covering the Apple-Qualcomm patent dispute for a while now, and like an ugly marriage, each side has found new ways to snipe at each other. First, a story in the Wall Street Journal reported that Apple is considering dropping Qualcomm chips from newer versions of its iPhone and iPad in favor of Intel and also maybe a company called MediaTek. And then a couple of days later, Qualcomm launched a new lawsuit against Apple alleging a breach of contract on software licensing.
You really can't blame Apple for saying, you know, this supplier is – because Qualcomm has been jerking Apple around for quite a few years now. This is just the latest in a series of Qualcomm trying to stick it to Apple. And, you know, I'm not standing up for Apple here, but certainly Qualcomm has a very poor reputation in treating its customers well over a 20 or 30-year period. They're, you know, not necessarily the nicest people to be a customer of. So I think Apple's making the right move here. You know, they're saying, okay, we don't really like Qualcomm and we're having a patent dispute. I suspect that, you know, even though Apple's having patent disputes or lawsuits with Samsung, they managed to keep a cordial business relationship. Maybe Qualcomm didn't keep a cordial and sort of tried to play hardball and say, well, we'll stop selling you our chips, or if you don't do this, we won't sell you any chips and you won't be able to produce the smartphone, blah, 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 blah. So I imagine that Apple went, right, okay, well, that game's going to be up, so let's go and work with somebody else.
You know. Yes, that's a very smart move. Absolutely. Yeah, I would do the same thing if I felt like a provider partner was bullying me.
Yeah, so I'm sure there's trouble here on both sides, and I'm not going to stand up for either side of this, but, you know, Apple does have a point here. It does like to use commodity components. Generally, Qualcomm chips have been the more advanced, but you've got to say that there's, you know, Intel's got the chops to make this work, and Apple has been running Intel chips in some of its iPhones for a while now. And that's usually how they bring on new suppliers. They bring on their chips, test them out at scale to make sure the company can manufacture them, give them a bit of an order to get them going, and then really start to wind it up. I mean, that's what the iPhone X was all about, right? They wanted to use this Face ID, but they couldn't produce the chips in, you know, tens of millions, but they could do it at less, a smaller number. They wanted to use better screens, but again, they couldn't manufacture them in. So part of the reason for having the iPhone X versus the 8 is to try and produce something that has these new features and try and, you know, work up the manufacturing so they can ship millions or tens of millions of these a month. So I think Apple's doing the same thing here. They could easily drop Qualcomm's components with a little bit of commitment. And at the end of the day, Apple's got the cash. They can go over to Intel and say, like, here's a $5 billion down payment on $10 billion worth of this thing.
Right.
And so Intel can easily turn around and say, I need $2 billion worth of silicon robots installed so I can meet this order. Do you know what I mean? Like,
oh, exactly. Yeah, they can drive dump trucks of cash up to any chip provider and say, let's make a deal.
That's right. And I suspect that Intel would, right now, Intel's a little bit stuck. It is struggling for revenue, so this would absolutely be...
They've got to be slavering at the mouth.
Got to be going like, oh, yeah, baby, thanks, Qualcomm.
Yeah, really. Send them a thank you note.
Yes, that's right. Send them some flowers to the Qualcomm CEO. Yeah. That'd be funny. That I doubt they would.
Funny. I know.
That's a very mean, 1980s thing to do. But
all right, another quick break to tell you about our other sponsor today, Interoptic. Greg, you can tell us more because you actually had a conversation with them.
Oh, yes. Interoptica is an SFP maker. So despite what your switch manufacturer would have you believe about optics, it's not just a cable. Your choice in optics matters, right? So you don't have to be stuck with the optics that the vendors want to sell you. You can actually get a much better price from your OEMs. But you want an OEM who's going to stand behind that product. Interoptic has a full product line. Now, the thing about SFP modules is they have code in them, and I've said this on several shows for quite a number of years, and it needs to be updated from time to time, especially if you want to be able to keep carrying those SFP forwards to different brands of switch or different line cards or different platforms. So make sure you choose an SFP vendor who knows how to do this so you don't have to suppress the alarms and then get caught out by tech support. OEM equivalent optics from Interoptic, they're a fraction of the cost, gives you control of your optics purchase. The growth around all this sort of stuff is just amazing. There's going to be so much optics going forward. You're not going to be using 10 base T. You're probably going to be using coax, which uses SFP modules, and you're going to be using optics for long haul, because even at 25 gig or even 10 gig, you're not getting 100 meters. You're only getting 50 most of the time, or even less, 30 sometimes. So you're not going to be able to trunk this stuff across your data center. You're going to need optics. So you start needing to start thinking about getting a company that can supply you these OEM optics and give you support for them. And as they claim here in the screed, from a hut in the Arctic Circle to the battlefield in Iraq, Interoptic has more than 4,000 customers across 7 continents. They've actually been doing this for about 15 years, so they seem to have something wrong. Go and visit interoptic.com/packet-pushers and contact them to get a quote. That's interoptic.com/packet-pushers and get a quote from them. And you can follow Interoptic on the socials as @getinterconnect. Thanks very much to Interoptic for sponsoring the show. And yeah, you can really save a lot of money by going OEM with your SFP modules. And I'm talking a lot.
All right, go save some cash. Last week, we talked about Cisco and Google partnering on a private cloud initiative. Now IBM has announced its own private cloud stack. They call it Cloud Private. This ticks all the must-have boxes, including support for Kubernetes orchestration and Docker containers. IBM's also rolling out containerized versions of WebSphere, Liberty Java, and DB2.
So it's not a private cloud, it's a cloud private.
I don't know what the difference is.
I mean, how many meetings and jocks with joss sticks and whale song did it take to come up with that name?
I'm sure a very highly paid consultant came up with that.
Yeah. So I think I'm not sure that quite what to make of this. On one hand, this is what I've been saying, is these vendors need to have a private cloud stack so that people can build cloud on-prem, so that they don't have to go to the public cloud. I think there's a substantial number of customers who either have reasons or just preference, you know, personal preferences. They want to be full stack. When I say full stack, they want to own the hardware and the software as well as the apps as well, right?
Yes.
And none of this pretend full stack software developers. I mean, that's just, they're just futzing around with code, right? So full stack includes the hardware as far as I'm concerned. So, you know, they're going to put in some Kubernetes, they're going to do some orchestration. Now, IBM is very heavily involved in these projects. And hypothetically, IBM's got all the pieces here. In my mind, can IBM make this stick? IBM has been very unsuccessful in getting software projects off the ground. It, you know, originally was a huge contributor to Open Daylight. It was a huge contributor to any number of open source projects. But it's very rarely been able to monetize these things. Its internal organization seems to just pull itself apart, if you know what I mean. Like, the salespeople don't ever get behind it because they'd much rather sell some mainframe or some microcomputers or some sort of, you know, mini computer or something that's much that they're used to, rather than getting on this new stuff.
Well, actually, maybe there's some alignment there, because one of the hardware platform options is an IBM mainframe. You can also run it on, you know, traditional COTS stuff that folks like Dell EMC will put together for you and get certified. But yes, mainframe is an option here. So maybe that's part of the package for internally for IBM.
I just can't, you know, IBM needs to get out of its own way, and I'm not sure that IBM's got the mobility. So they've got the chops, the technology, they've got the people. I've got no doubt they can build a product, but can they get the management and the salespeople and the field engineers behind this and say to customers, right, all that stuff we did yesterday, that's all dead. You need to be into this. And can IBM actually do that, right?
Right.
In short, probably not. Based on everything that's happened in the last 10 years, probably not.
All right, well, they've put their stake in the ground. We'll keep an eye on it and see what happens.
That's right. We'll see if a dog comes up and pisses on it so the electricity goes to earth. Yeah.
Oh, no. Moving on, Arista reported its third quarter 2017 financials with some eye-popping or perhaps even champagne-popping numbers. First, the company posted Q3 revenues of $434 million. That's up 8% from the second quarter, but up more than 50% from 2016. That's pretty good.
Oh boy, did they go hard, right? September sales of 430 million. That's 51% year on year, 8% quarter on quarter. So that's, they're selling 50% as much product as they did this time last year.
I believe the term is selling like hotcakes.
Yes, I do believe so. But managed to also sustain profit margins and a whole bunch of other things. So all of the metrics are just like, you know, eye-poppingly amazing. I was reading the call transcript where Arista was talking to the analysts. Basically, the CEO said Arista has experienced unprecedented growth in the first 3 quarters of this year with stronger than expected demand from our major cloud titan customers. My emphasis.
Cloud titan, nice.
Cloud titan. Due to this unforeseen demand for initial 100 gigabit routing and switching deployments, we've been experiencing almost 50% growth in the past 3 quarters instead of the more normal 20 to 30% consensus growth. I think the suggestion here is that the big cloud companies are turning to Arista for chassis. That would be my interpretation. They're making their own top-of-rack switches, you know, their 1RU. They're making their own servers. They feel they have the competency for that, for the bulk of their stuff, but they still need those big chassis to build. You know, when you're building a data center with an 80 to 150,000 servers in it, you still need chassis to make those spines work. And I think Arista is basically the only company left that's building a chassis that the cloud providers want to buy. Brocade's gone. Avaya's, you know, Alcalu is over at Nokia. I don't think they're really looking at the cloud titans as a target market. Cisco's chassis has a pretty poor reputation from most of what I've heard. So really, who are you going to buy it from? And that's pretty much Arista. So, but then again, we've also seen companies like HP and Cisco. Well, HP has gotten out of selling to cloud titans completely, you know, except for boutique, you know, off the shelf. You know, if you want some of our off-the-shelf servers, sure, we'll sell you those, but we're not going to make you a custom server.
I feel like the tone of the financial reporting announcement was very modest. There wasn't a lot of chest thumping because I think Arista is clearly aware that what the cloud titans give, the cloud titans can also take away.
Yes. So, yeah, I just felt that they're aware of that and they're trying to say to the investors, look, just relax.
Right.
You know, if the cloud titans suddenly
please, God, don't get used to 50% growth.
I do think so. So a couple of other smaller things. There was one comment about patents. They said, following the July ITC order, we introduced our 945 workaround features in mid-September. So this is where the International Trade Commission said that Arista was breaking the patent, so they couldn't import their gear while they broke this specific patent. They introduced a workaround and since mid-September and obviously have managed to keep gear shipping. So whether it's a software or a hardware workaround, I don't know. If it was a hardware, they certainly managed to keep the gear in the pipeline.
Yeah, and this is part of their longstanding patent dispute with Cisco.
Yeah, we haven't heard much on it lately, which is a bit of a shame. It's always, you know, free money for...
Well, we've got Qualcomm and Apple to fill the gap for us. So.
For punditry. And they also made some comments about they're seeing strong uptake on their switches being used as routers. So if I was Juniper, and I'd be a bit nervous here because the Cloud Titans have a reputation for using Juniper's MX series routers or PTX series routers at the edge of their clouds. And if they are starting to see them reusing the existing switches, the R series, as routers, then that might have some knock-on effects into the industry. So it'll be interesting to see how that works out over time. At the end of the day, what we expect from routers is changing. And a lot of the people could just use those guys as that. So pretty amazing results for Arista. Must be galling for Cisco, though, right?
It's got to be, yes. It's got to
yeah.
be. Right.
You know, because at this point, you know, September, so to have 438 million in sales in a quarter, that means they're getting up towards a $2 billion run rate. You know, that's close to the entire sales of ACI for a year. And that's just switches and hardware. That's not software or any of that other stuff. So, yeah, gotta be galling for Cisco to not have defeated Arista and to actually see customers actively rejecting Cisco and saying, no, Cisco over there, go back in your box. We're choosing Arista en masse.
Yeah, and the fourth quarter projections were also in line with what we're seeing in the third quarter. So it's rolling.
Yeah. I wouldn't rush out and buy the stock, though. As George Notter from Jefferies says, he says, you know, this stock is already highly priced. The risk reward is balanced. So sure, the price jumped 6.5%, I think, as at yesterday. It'll probably pop a little bit more, but you know, a little bit, it's already, all of this stuff is already priced in. People were pretty much expecting this. If you want to bet on Amazon buying more Arista switches or Azure or whatever, well, that's good for you.
That's your money.
That's a good horse race to be in, I guess.
All right. Our last story for the day, the Associated Press is reporting that chipmaker Broadcom is going to legally relocate its business address to Delaware in the United States. By incorporating in Delaware, you get all kinds of goodies. For one, Broadcom can avoid the foreign review for its proposed Brocade acquisition because it will be a U.S. company. They also get lots of delicious tax breaks. They get more privacy as business owners. And apparently there's the way that Delaware settles legal disputes, it happens in front of a judge instead of a jury, which I think businesses prefer.
Yeah, so this just has the stink of, oh, that's convenient. Why don't I do that?
Oh, yes.
You know, it's literally a legal move. It's not a real move. So it's not like Broadcom is suddenly moving Asian operations to the USA. The politicians, of course, have jumped over it. In particular, President Trump in the US is trumpeting how amazing he is for bringing this company to the US and blah, blah, blah. And in fact, he'd been leaking about it all week. He'd been saying, I've got a huge announcement coming. But this is literally just a nominal paper move for a company that's currently when Avago took over Broadcom, it was based in Asia. It Singapore. Now makes more sense in Singapore. Yep. And it just right now, it just makes more sense for it to be domiciled in the US. It's trying to bribe Brocade and get that $5.5 billion deal locked down. It's got a bunch of other deals. It wants to do some stuff. So I think it just wasn't too hard for them. It's not like they've had to. And the fact that they get to rub up against somebody famous probably doesn't hurt at all. So I don't think this is a big deal, really.
It does seem like sort of legal and tax implication move more than anything else. Delaware should not be expecting a Broadcom factory to be opening up anytime.
Not in Delaware. It's just a place where you incorporate companies because the local law is convenient.
That's right.
You know, we already have enough of that. So I do think that, you know, this is just we've got some things that we're doing in the US. It makes sense for us to move there and, you know, we can get some political mileage out of it as well. All right, great. Let's do that.
Bing, bang, boom. All right, that brings us to the end of the show. Greg, where can folks get more from you?
I'm hanging around on the Twitters as @EtherealMind. That's where I do most of my work, weekly snark. But I do occasionally drop in on LinkedIn. I've been slow on blogging this week because of health issues, but I should be returning to a more regular schedule on my personal microblog at etherealmind.com.
All right, and I've got a blog of yours to edit and post right after the show. Yes, and I'm Drew Conroy-Murray. I'm on Twitter @Drew_CM, and I blog at packetpushers.net. Thanks to our sponsors, Thousand Eyes and Interoptic. And of course, thanks to you for joining us for this episode of Network Break. If you like the show, share it around, put it on Facebook, leave a recommendation on iTunes, give it to your friends, and check out our membership program at packetpushers.net/members. It's free to sign up, and you get the Human Infrastructure Magazine and Link Propagation newsletters, as well as exclusive member content. Thanks for listening.